David, tell me a bit about the center, the institute at the University of Alberta. What is it that you're trying to do at your center?
Well, the center is a new initiative, and the an important facet of these diseases concerns the logistics, the nuts and bolts of them, and to deal with them at the lab bench, you need special containment labs, special equipment, and you also need to have people who have different expertise in different disciplines that can all focus on the same problem. So what we are attempting to create in the center is that environment. We have a physical environment that's able to handle prion disease tissue and prion proteins at the lab bench in safety. And we also have a collection of scientists who bring different disciplines to the table in working out the nuts and bolts of these diseases. So there are scientists, actually we have a building, a new building, and there's people, scientists located inside the building, and then in a slightly lower level of focus, I mean, the building is also a hub for other researchers within our university and other universities in Alberta and yet other researchers across Canada.
So are you looking at just the animal portion of prion diseases, or are you looking at the human aspect as well?
Most of our focus is on the animal versions of prion diseases. Thankfully, the human versions are fairly rare, and we hope they're going to stay that way. But I understand the animal versions in yet greater degrees of detail, we will be addressing the scenario that under certain specialized conditions that animal prion diseases can migrate into humans. That's not normally the case, but the one exception that's really the catalyst for all of these activities is of course, mad cow disease, bovine spongiform encephalopathy.
We're here at a conference that is looking at research that's being conducted across Canada as well as around the world. What is the state of prion research today?
Well, prion research happens by increments. So looking over the sort of time frame of 20 years ago, people were only getting the faintest inklings of what's going on. There's been a process of consolidation, and we have a much greater understanding of these diseases and the family of diseases, and also how the sort of outer edges of prion diseases overlap other human protein folding diseases. And so those overlaps are quite informative. I mean, there have been advances in technologies that have been tried and tested in labs around the world. So we are better at providing small animal models that can give us important snapshots into the processes of prion diseases, and are even there are even a very rapid tests that involve amplifying prion proteins at the lab bench. Those are somewhat of a cutting edge. They're quite powerful technologies. We know they have some quirks that we need to understand a little bit more, but nonetheless, that has probably been a conceptual advance, and that particular technique to amplify prions in a test tube at the bench instead of growing it in a plate of petri dish of cells. That particular technique is called PMCA, so that's a sort of chain reaction for making prions in the test tube.
Well, you talked about the interest in the overlap of diseases, for example, Alzheimer's, and then a talk that we were just listening to this morning, also Parkinson's disease was brought into the mix. What's happening on that the human side, looking at Alzheimer's versus, say, mad cow or some of the other diseases?
Yes, well, that is developing. Many years ago, it was suggested as a theoretical possibility because we had we firmed up the conclusion that prion diseases were the disease of misfolded proteins, and there was a misfolded protein known in Alzheimer's disease. So they were parallel observations. You can imagine them sort of sitting in different fields, different areas, but now we're understanding the overlaps a little bit more. And this started it started to build momentum. Originally, some neuropathologists noted that there were very rare but rather strange incidences where patients had both prion disease and Alzheimer disease. And some of these could be written off as trivial observations, but some of them didn't seem to be trivial. In 2006, there was a paper published where it was shown that some aspects of the way in which prion disease is spread through the brain, that some rather similar phenomena were occurring in the case of the misfolded protein of Alzheimer's disease. And just as misfolded proteins in prion disease come in slightly different flavors, slightly different varieties, there was some experiments done to suggest that the same is true of the misfolded protein of Alzheimer's disease. And that protein in Alzheimer's disease is called the amyloid beta peptide. In a very recent time frame, last week, there was a provocative paper published in the journal Nature where it was found out that the precursor prion protein, that is to say, the prion protein we all have that is not infectious, that gets misfolded, that this particular precursor prion protein plays a role in Alzheimer's disease in the way that brain cells, neurons in Alzheimer's disease, are not activating their electrical impulses correctly. So whereas previously the prion protein itself, that is highly conserved and we all have a lot of it in our brains, it was a little bit of a sort of a side mystery that was captivating intellectually, but maybe not super important. Well, I think that's changed around a little bit, that understanding this protein has been sort of put back on the front burner now to just put it under microscope yet more to explore this relationship with Alzheimer's disease.
You say it's provocative. Why provocative?
Why provocative? Well, I mentioned earlier that human prion diseases are thankfully very rare. Well, exactly the opposite is true of Alzheimer's disease, that is regrettably very common. I mean, everyone knows someone, relative or a neighbor, who has Alzheimer's disease. It's very common as one ages. So it's provocative in the sense that we've been working on molecules in prion disease in some ways a sort of limited window where we're concerned in the Canadian context, the catalyst was the livestock industry, but now we realize that there's a bigger window that seems to have opened up that tells us about a very common disease.
Alzheimer's, though, is not infectious, whereas something like mad cow disease does go from animal to animal. So what makes the difference between the two? Why is one infective and the other not?
Yes, that's a good question. I think there's two parts to that answer. One, why is a prion disease infectious? The cellular prion protein that I mentioned a few moments ago that we all have has a few little design features in it that are quite unusual that allow it to hop from one cell to another, and therefore you have, when it gets changed over, it's probably the different, the bad form of the protein that is misfolded, it still can retain these design features that allow it to hop from one cell to another. So that's the simple answer, and one of the features is at the front of the molecule and the other, another one is at the back. So there's even some redundancy, there's two ways this protein can get from one cell to another. So you'd have a scenario where one cell is infected and the neighboring cell is not infected. Well, if you have this ability to flip from one cell to another, then you go to a situation where one cell is infected and the neighboring cell also becomes infected. The second issue where the overlap is interesting is even in prion disease, there are versions of the protein that build up and amplify. We would say they replicate. And we're not exactly confident that those forms of the protein that build up and replicate are automatically the forms of the protein that kill the brain cells. Brain cells are killed in prion disease. If they weren't killed, then we wouldn't have neurological symptoms and animals would be healthy and humans would be healthy and we wouldn't care about it. But in fact, there is this toxicity. And whereas another facet of prion disease that's not represented in Alzheimer's disease is this amplification phenomenon, toxicity phenomenon is common to both diseases. And in fact, there is very similar findings that there are some assemblies, it's just not one molecule on its own, but some little cluster of molecules that's probably the toxic form of the prion protein in a prion disease, and there's an assembly of the misfolded protein of Alzheimer's disease, the amyloid beta peptide, there's an assembly of that that is the toxic form of that protein.
So have we made any headway, though, on understanding what actually makes the prion protein misfold?
Yes, it is really at a cutting edge of chemical biology. Proteins in cells are like the verbs in the sentence. They do the actions of the cells. And if you change the shape of a protein, then it doesn't do quite the right action. And that's, at a broad sense, what is going on in prion disease. Now, scientists study protein molecules, and they go from on a gradient from easy to difficult. And unfortunately, the prion protein lies at the difficult end of the spectrum because it is a protein that is associated with membranes, that is with the lipid, the fat, the fatty part of a cell. So those proteins are not so soluble in water, and they're rather tricky to study. So and as the prion protein undergoes this change in shape, it becomes yet less soluble. So the sort of standard techniques that one uses to look at proteins at a very high level of detail, actually at the level of atoms, they don't work for the prion protein. Now, there have been some technical tricks and workarounds to deal with that, and we are slowly getting there. So 10 years ago, we knew in broad outline, yes, that one form of the protein changes, and this bit changes, and this other bit doesn't change, and we can make sort of a catalogue, and that our level of resolution in the important parts of the molecule is improving, but it is a incremental business. It's very tricky technologically, and it's so tricky that some labs don't exactly take the bull by the horns. I mean, you have to study the infectious protein that needs special labs to protect against the infectivity, and that would actually, in a way, bring me back to the first point I was making about you need special laboratories, and that's what we're setting up at the University of Alberta. And of that particular issue, the ultra high level detail of defining the change from a good protein to a bad protein, that is on our list of things to do, and we've been equipping ourselves to tackle that specific question.
Well, I've learned two new terms or words. One is chaperone and the other is shadow. What are those terms? What do they refer to?
Yes, chaperone, it became clear maybe starting 15 years ago that proteins have shapes, but sometimes they need other proteins to get into the right shape. They can't quite do it on their own. It used to be thought that a protein would, the proteins are first made as like a piece of string, and then they fold up into a shape. It was thought that they could do that in an unassisted fashion. But then it became clear that other proteins help them do that, because sometimes they start to fold up in the right shape and they sort of get stuck halfway and a part of it goes into the wrong shape. And then the chaperone comes along and sort of unfolds it a bit more, smooths it out, and then lets it get into the right shape. And the term that protein chemists use to describe shape is conformation. So chaperones are helper molecules that help important proteins hit the right conformation. Now, the field of chaperones is well known in the science of cell biology for proteins inside the cell, and there are chaperone proteins that are described. Again, prion disease is a bit more of a cutting edge, because it seems that there may well be chaperone-type activity involved, maybe in the wrong way, in helping a good protein go bad. But it would be interesting, because some of the crucial events of refolding or misfolding are not so clear they're going on inside the cell. In fact, they may be going on outside the cell. Now, the field of chaperone molecules working outside of cells is not so well developed, but that's, I think that's an important frontier that will bear close scrutiny in the coming years.
And SHADU?
Yes, SHADU is something that I won't exactly say we stumbled upon, but we certainly became very interested in the last couple of years. So we have known about this normal prion protein in the brain for I think we're just coming up to the 25th anniversary. And it turns out that, in fact, there is quite a related protein in the brain as well, and that has this rather curious name, SHADU, which I hasten to add that we didn't invent, but the protein was a theoretical protein identified by looking at the sequences of chromosomes, the DNA sequences of chromosomes. People saw this sequence on a chromosome and thought, well, maybe that could make a protein. So in my lab, my student Joel Watts looked further into that and indeed found out there is a protein, and actually it's quite abundant. It's another neuronal protein, and it has a lot of features that are similar to the normal prion protein. So we think that they may be part of a family of molecules on the surface of brain cells that help brain cells deal with damage. And that is our sort of working idea to do with the SHADU molecule. Now, that is in the context of a healthy brain cell. Since we are always interested in unhealthy brain cells in prion disease, because, again, it's this issue of toxicity, what's going wrong, we have looked at what happens to the SHADU protein in an animal that has a prion disease. And it's a simple question, and we were a little surprised to get a very simple answer, that the SHADU protein starts to disappear. Now, at the moment, we're working out why it disappears. We've done this experiment many times in animals with different types of prion diseases and in petri dishes full of cells that you can infect with prions, and it seems to be a pretty reliable observation. So in one sense, the fact that the SHADU protein disappears when animals are replicating prions, it sort of makes it what we call a tracer. We didn't expect to make this discovery, but somehow when the protein is disappearing, it's telling you that prions are replicating. So maybe in the future we'd better use that in a practical sense, but for the time being we just have a very firm observation in the lab that we'd just like to understand the molecular nuts and bolts of when one protein is accumulating, the other one disappears. So that's our sort of a short-term task in the lab right now.
When you say it disappears, is it being cannibalized by other molecules?
Well, that is one possibility, yes. So I mentioned chaperone proteins that are proteins that help other proteins get in shape. And there is another class of proteins called proteases that help chop up proteins when they're no longer needed. And there's quite a big literature and interest in the field of prion disease, and especially so in Alzheimer's disease, about these chopping proteins that go under the name of proteases. So one possibility is the SHADU protein in a prion disease suddenly becomes a candidate for being presented to a protease, and then it's chopped up. And proteases come in different forms as well. There's quite a variety of them, and you can chop up proteins in different parts of the cells, outside the cells, inside the cells, inside membranes. So part of the detective work is to look into that and see which type of protease might be involved.
What gaps do you think there are right now?
Well, the crucial gap is this ultra-high resolution structure of an infectious prion protein, and to understand the exact steps whereby a normal protein may get unfolded and turned into the bad form. I think that is a crucial area of fundamental science, and I think by understanding that we'll have it has practical ramifications. If you know exactly what is the bad part of the molecule, that's where you direct your best diagnostics and your best therapeutics, that is to stop it happening. But also you can address some of the other aspects of prion biology. We know in humans human prion diseases are, I mentioned, rare, but they're very instructive. And we know that in humans there are so-called sporadic prion diseases where people get the disease but they haven't been infected. That's a very rare occurrence, thankfully. But it is becoming a little clearer that there is an analogous process in animals and in livestock. Again, luckily we suspect it's very rare, but with because it's unpredictable, it can be a bit tricky. And one can imagine a scenario where you have a flock of some type of livestock animal that is perfectly healthy, but if one of these sporadic events happens in them, then that could be a problem, because that animal, once it is infected, could infect its flock mates. So we'd like to understand that process better, and we believe that that would be a practical value so we can deal with this possibility of sporadic disease. It was a theoretical possibility in livestock animals, but now it seems to be more of a real possibility, and I think we'd just like to understand it a little bit more.
Thank you very much, David.
Okay. You're very welcome.